Okay, Romans chapter 5. We finished the first half of the chapter. And let me ask you at this point, what is our key to experiencing the riches of Romans? Because we've gone over from our justification, therefore being justified by faith, and we've gone over five rich results of our justification and ended with, we joy in God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, what is necessary on our part in order to experience the full benefit of those riches? Faith. Okay, we are justified by, we have access by, are we supposed to really glory in tribulations? Yes, very good. And if we glory in tribulations, why is that? Because we have, okay, God calls us to a radical faith. If you're glorying in tribulations, and to tell you the truth, guys, I don't know a lot of folks that glory in tribulations. And it's very few, very rare, but I do know some. I have met some Christians that do actually glory in tribulations. If you are glorying in tribulations, it's for one reason only. You know what God says is true about them, and you believe it. It's by faith. God calls us to a radical faith, and that's the key to experiencing the benefits of this epistle right from the outset. I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Keynote to the Holy Epistle. The just shall live by faith. And this epistle is about living by faith. Gaining life through faith, that's how we gain initially that eternal life that's ours. And that's how we live it out, too. All a matter of faith. Faith is the key. Okay, somebody want to take a stab at summing up for me the main argument, the main teaching of Romans 5, 6 through 10? Somebody want to take a stab at summing it up? The argument from the greater to the lesser. Somebody sum up for me what that means, the significance of it. Okay, great. If God sent His only begotten Son, His beloved Son, to die for us, for our sins, when we were in a wretched, miserable, helpless state, how much more is He going to do for us to make sure we go all the way home to heaven, or even beyond that, okay? The whole rest of the salvation package is what He's saying. The whole argument is, if He's already done the greater, harder thing, when we were least deserving, how much more is He going to do for us now that we are sons? If He has done the greater thing for us when we were slime, how much more is He going to do whatever lesser thing it takes now that we are sons? Now, how would that affect our justification? How would that affect our view of our justification? Any particular way? It means eternal security. I think this is one of the most, if not the most, powerful arguments for eternal security. Certainly, if God invested His Son for us when we were ungodly, without strength, hardened sinners, incorrigible, habitual sinners, and enemies, active enemies against God, if He invested His Son in us at that state, what terrible thing can we do to lose it now? And what lesser thing would He fail to do for us to take us all the way home, to ensure our ultimate, absolute, final salvation? He is able to save us to the uttermost, Hebrews tells us. That means to the very final end, to the final bit. One of the strongest, clearest, most powerful arguments for eternal security right here. This is enough to convince me of eternal security, right there. God did it all at Calvary. What lesser thing could be necessary and could He fail to do to make sure we get all the way home? So it affects our eternal security. How might it affect our sanctification? What's that? He will carry us all the way through. He's done the greater, harder thing for us when we were slime, when we were outcasts, when we were rebels, when we were totally undeserving. Now that we are His sons, He will certainly do whatever it takes to assure our salvation, not just from the penalty for sin, but from the power of sin. Right? You see how it affects that as well? This is a lesser thing that He's called upon to do, to take us through in our sanctification. It's a powerful, complete package of salvation. How might it affect even our glorification? This might be a little tricky here. It's already completed. And it even has to do with the hour of wrath that's poured out upon the earth, doesn't it? I think there's a promise here that we're delivered from every form of wrath, that He will take us home and exempt us from that hour. the Great Tribulation. I believe that's all part of the passage. Our guarantee that we have an absolute, complete package of salvation and that our salvation is final and secure is what? What's our guarantee? Our firm, unyielding, unchanging guarantee. What? The love of God, which is expressed and given assurance of in two ways. What are those two ways? The inner witness, the love of God shed abroad in our hearts by the Holy Ghost, which is given to us, and the objective witness, which is the work of Christ at Calvary, which is once and for all displayed before the entire world, the cross. Okay? Good. You all seem to be getting it. Our salvation from the penalty of sin is perfect and it's unfailing. Our salvation from the power of sin is also perfect and unfailing. But what's the key on our part? Faith. We got to believe it. The power is there. The power is there. The sufficiency is entirely of Christ. It's more than enough. It's there. We just have to believe. And God calls us to a radical faith. If we can glory in tribulations, we certainly can count on Him to sanctify us. Okay? These are good things to be thinking about as we enter into the next section. Okay, anybody like to take a stab at the outline thus far? Okay, somebody tell me just the introduction, the references for the introduction. Romans 1. Okay, good. All right, you're all going to do it. That's good. Introduction 1:1 through 1:17. Somebody want to get rid of that? Get out of there. Okay, somebody want to give me the first plank of the outline? Roman numeral 1. Okay, and the references? 3:20, isn't it? Is that right? Okay, 3:20. Yeah, 3:20. Okay, righteousness required is the first one. Roman numeral 2. Okay, righteousness reckoned, very good. And the references? Okay, good. 3:21 through 5:11. Second plank of the outline. Roman numeral 2, salvation, righteousness reckoned. Third one? Five, 12, 3, 39. Okay, I heard it in there somewhere. Okay, that's good. You know, if I had time, I would drill you on this. Guy that used to teach here, Pastor Rich Wager, is an adjunct teacher years ago. He was a he was discipled, led to the Lord, and discipled by Lance Latham. And he was one of his white shirt brigade, used to go around as a young man singing various churches with Lance Latham. And he taught Hebrews here for a while. And he gave them an outline of the book of Hebrews. He used to drill the class with it every morning, just about for a while. But I don't have the time to do that. That's one way to learn it, though. Go over it at home. Make sure you know it. Make sure you know that outline, okay? All right, we're in the third section now of the book of Romans, as far as the outline goes, sanctification. Righteousness realized, Romans 5:12 through 8:39. And this second half, the latter half of chapter 5 of Romans, is kind of a preface to the sanctification section. It's kind of a preface. And it sets forth for us this truth, that there are, in effect, two races of men in the world. There are two races. There are two men, so to speak. Each race is headed up by a man. And God sees the whole race as really identified or included in this one man. So two men, each representing a separate race of humankind. You could speak of it as two Adams, but actually the more scriptural term is two men. Okay? Two races, two men. One race has nothing to look forward to but condemnation and wrath. They are completely under condemnation and wrath. That is their lot, that is their portion for one race. And one race of men, their lot, their portion, is justification and life. So the whole issue is, which man represents you? Which race do you belong to? Because one race is condemnation and wrath, and one race is justification and life. And there are only two races, and you're one or the other. Okay, that's the truth set forth in Romans 5:12 through 21. Romans chapter 6, 7, and 8 expands on two phrases from the early half of Romans chapter 5. It expands on the phrase saved by his life in Romans 5, verse 10. For if when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son, much more being reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. And I told you that really what that means is we shall be saved in the power of his life. Saved in the power of his life. Identification with Christ, the key to our sanctification, that is expanded on in Romans 6, 7, and 8. And then in the latter half of Romans chapter 8, something else is expanded on, where it says in Romans chapter 5, we rejoice in hope of the glory of God in verse 2. Romans 5, verse 2. By whom also we have access by faith into this grace wherein we stand and rejoice in hope of the glory of God. So Romans 6, 7, and the first half of Romans chapter 8 expands on saved in the power of his life. And the latter half of Romans chapter 8 expands on rejoice in hope of the glory of God. One speaks of our sanctification, one speaks of our glorification. And those are the great topics of this section coming up. And this is thrilling stuff. I always love to get to this point in the book of Romans. So we come into Romans chapter 5, verse 12. It says, wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed where there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned, after the similitude of Adam's transgression, who was the figure of him that was to come. What does all that mean? I don't know about you, but for me, that for a long time was a complicated little nugget of Scripture. Those three verses. That was kind of a tangle for me. But let me sum it up for you and try and straighten out the tangle, untangle the tangle. Romans 5, 12 through 14 is talking about a very key principle that we must understand for the rest of the section. The principle of federal headship. That's a big fancy title, but it's really not that difficult, not that complicated. Federal headship is simply this. I receive the consequences of one man's act because I'm identified with that man. He is my federal head. He is the head of the race to which I belong. I belong to one of two races. And each race has its own federal head. One man that stands for the whole race. The whole race is included in that one man, in God's reckoning. Federal headship means I receive the consequences of one man's act, my federal head, because I am identified with that man. I'm included in his consequences, because as far as God's concerned, I'm included in his act. That's the principle of federal headship. You find that in 2 Corinthians 5. Don't lose your place in Romans, if you're going to turn, but 2 Corinthians 5, verse 14, tremendous verse, says, for the love of Christ constraineth us, because we thus judge that if one died for all, then we're all dead. And that he died for all, that they which live should not henceforth live unto themselves, but unto him which died for them and rose again. Federal headship. If one died for all, then we're all dead. Federal headship. I'm included in the consequences of one man's act. What happens to one man happens to me, because I'm included in the consequences, because I'm identified with the man. And that he died for all, that they which live should not henceforth live unto themselves, but unto him which died for them and rose again. Verse 12 of Romans 5, wherefore as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned in this one man. As far as God is concerned, I'm included in the act, I'm included in the consequences. Yeah. Yeah, where they send that one champion to fight. Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of a picture of it. That's kind of a picture of it. And here's another picture of it. You got in the army. You got the army got two divisions in this one camp, in this one encampment. And they break it up into these two groups, and they say, we're going to have one man from each group represent the whole group. Okay, we've got Bubba. And we've got Benji. Yeah. Bubba and Benji. You're either in Bubba's group or you're in Benji's group. If you're in Bubba's group, you're Bubba. We see you as Bubba. The army likes to simplify things. They like to systematize things. And they depersonalize things. So if you're in Bubba's group, as far as they're concerned, you're Bubba. If you're in Benji's group, as far as they're concerned, you're Benji. You come forth on a day where, you know, they're passing out the mess, and the menu says macaroni and cheese for Bubba, meatloaf for Benji. And you show up and you say, I'd like the macaroni and cheese. Well, which group are you? Benji. No, you get the meatloaf. Sorry, no macaroni and cheese for you. You're Benji. Oh, no, no, my name's not Benji. My name's Bruce. No, you're Benji, because you're in Benji's group. Okay? The green khakis go to Bubba, and the orange uniforms go to Benji. Benji's a little fruity, okay? Benji's a little weird. But you got the green, and you got the orange. Bubba gets his leave this weekend. Benji gets his leave next weekend. If you want your leave this weekend, you better be Bubba, or you don't get your leave. You're Benji, you get your leave next weekend. Okay? You're identified with that one man. That one man represents you. He is your federal head. And as far as the Army is concerned, you are Bubba or Benji. You're not Bartolomeo. You're not Basil. You're not Bruce. You're not Billy Joe. You're Bubba or Benji. That's it. You're identified with one of two men, so you're included in all the consequences that one man receives, in all the portion that is one man's. Kind of follow that? That's another picture of it. You're identified with one man or the other. It's simple. One of two races. So that's the principle, federal headship. I receive the consequences of one man's act because I'm identified with that man. Now, here's the application of that principle. The application of the principle, according to Romans 5, 12 through 14, is I inherit one thing or the other. I either inherit life or death. Whether I inherit life or death for me depends on which man is my federal head. Whether I get the macaroni and cheese or the meatloaf, whether I get the green uniform or the orange uniform, whether I get weekend leave this weekend or next weekend, depends on which man is my federal head. There are no other choices. And that is absolute. The issue of death or life depends for me on which man is my federal head. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. All were in Adam's race. All were seen as in Adam. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed where there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression, or in the same way that Adam sinned, who is the figure of him that was to come. So the question is, am I a member of Adam's race or Christ's race? Because the issues of life or death depend for me on which race I'm a member of. Now, I'm not talking here just about physical death. I'm talking about something broader and deeper. I'm talking about the whole experience, my whole life experience. Will it be an experience of death or life? I'm not just talking physical death. I'm talking eternal death, eternal life. I'm talking the whole experience, the whole character of life and death. Which will be my experience? Which will be my lot? Which will be my portion? It depends on which race I belong to, Adam or Christ. Okay, that's the application of the principle. The principle is federal headship. I receive the full consequences of one man's act because I am in that man or identified with that man. Now, the proof of the principle, according to this little passage, verse 12 through 14, is universal death. The universal death. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, Adam, and death came through sin, death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. Is he talking about their individual sins? I believe he's saying that all men sinned in Adam. When Adam sinned, as far as God's concerned, all mankind sinned. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed where there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned, after the similitude, or in the same way as Adam's transgression, who is the figure of him that was to come. The proof of the principle of federal headship is you look around all throughout this world, and what you see everywhere are graves, cemeteries, headstones. Everywhere you look. And what does that tell you? Everybody dies. And what does that mean? It says, even from Adam to Moses, everybody died. From Adam to Moses, that was the universal experience of man, with the exception of Enoch. Okay? With the exception of Enoch, who walked with God and was taken, He was not. But other than that, all men die. What does that tell us? Everywhere you look, there's cemeteries. I drove up to, with my family this summer, drove up to the Durham Missions Institute in Canada. First time we've ever been there. Wanted our kids to see it. The Dustins invited us. Todd Dustin and his family invited us to be up there, spend some time with them. Anybody remember the Dustins? Okay. And we went up there to visit them. We had a long drive up through Canada. It's very rural. A lot of open, empty spaces. A lot of little towns far in between. But what you saw a lot of is hard to escape noticing cemeteries. Big cemeteries, little cemeteries, all kinds of cemeteries on the way. Kept seeing cemeteries. Everywhere you look, folks, people die. Everywhere you look, you have cemeteries, graveyards. What does that tell you? Well, where there's smoke, there's fire. Where there's smoke, there's fire. Where there's death, there's sin. Because the wages of sin is death. And God said to Adam and Eve, but of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat thereof. For in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. Genesis 2:17. Ezekiel 18, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. The wages of sin is death. Where there's smoke, there's fire. You see smoke, you know there's a fire. You see death, you know there's got to be sin. You know, see those TV shows and those movies that always have these emergency room physicians laboring to keep this guy alive. They're jumping all over his chest and they're pumping and they're applying the electric shock and they're doing everything to keep this guy alive. What happens? He finally expires. They've spent all their efforts. They're exhausted. And some attending physician will say, you know, in a dragged out, tired, weary voice, he says, you know, got to fill out the birth certificate. Call it. What time? Such and such a time. And then he says, cause of death. And they usually say, you know, massive heart failure or something like that. I'm waiting for the day when this physician says, cause of death, and somebody in the room says, sin, just like every other time, just like always, just like the guy before him and the guy after him, sin was the cause of death. Because wherever there's death, it's because initially the cause was sin. Death came into the world because sin came into the world. Where there's smoke, there's fire. Where there's graves, that means there's been sin. There's death, they're saying. Everywhere you look, there's graves. So, universal death. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned, the same way Adam sinned. What's he saying here? Adam is the figure of him that was to come, a figure of Christ, kind of a type of Christ in this way. What's the cause of death here? Sin is the cause of death. From Adam to Moses, there was no formal law given. We didn't have the tablets of stone. We didn't have the Mosaic law. There was no formal law given. Without law, there's no transgression that is counted against man. Individual sins are not imputed against men where there's no formal law. That's what it says here. Sin is not imputed where there is no law. Sin is not reckoned where there is no law. It's talking about individual sins. So, folks, we've got a problem here, don't we? We've got universal death. We've got all these people dying from Adam to Moses. And there's no formal law in that space. So none of them sinned the same way Adam sinned, because Adam had a formal commandment. Okay? They didn't have a formal law, God says, that they could sin against, so they didn't sin in the same way Adam did. Nevertheless, there's death, which means there must be sin. This is the proof of the principle of federal headship. It says, nevertheless, sin was in the world. Sin was in the world. In verse 13, but sin is not imputed where there is no law. Now look at this. Sin in the world, we're not talking here about individual sins. And this is an abrupt change, a significant change you've got to notice in the book of Romans. Up to this point, we've been talking about sins, plural. Sins with an S. Individual acts of sin. Up to this point in the book of Romans. But henceforth, our focus will not be individual sins, but it will be sin, singular, as an entity. Sin, singular, is our focus now. Sin as a principle. Sin as an entity. It's a big shift, and a significant one. Sin was in the world, it says. For until the law, sin was in the world. But there was no law at this point. From Adam to Moses, sin is not imputed where there is no law. Now, sin, the Greek word is hamartia. We have martyrology as the theology of sin, the study of sin and how it's affected man. Look with me at 1 John chapter 3, verse 4 for a minute. 1 John 3, verse 4, something you have to understand about sin. And follow with me, because here's where Paul gets real lawyer-like. First John 3, verse 4. It's a simple little verse. It says, "Whosoever committeth sin transgresseth also the law, for sin is the transgression of the law." In the Greek, that last phrase says, sin, hamartia, is anomia. King James translators chose to translate that transgression of the law. But in the Greek, it's a little more absolute. It says, sin, hamartia, is anomia. Now, nomos is the word for law. Anomia, as the prefix a, which negates it, like anapologetos, no excuse, no apology, no defense. So what do you suppose anomia is? Lawlessness. Hamartia is lawlessness. I believe what it's saying in 1 John 3, 4, everyone that doeth sin transgresseth the law, and sin is lawlessness. Sin is transgression of the law. Sin is lawlessness. Sin is anomia. I believe we're talking here about sin as the basic inward principle that works in the hearts of men. There's an inward principle of sin in the world, works in the hearts of men, according to Romans chapter 5, and that inward principle of sin is lawlessness. That's the essence of sin. That's the deep underlying inward principle of sin, hamartia. You commit acts of sin because you've got the inward principle of sin working in your heart, and the inward principle of sin is lawlessness. What that means a little more clearly, the inward working of lawlessness is a refusal to be under control. The casting off, the throwing off of all restraint. The defiance against any regulation or any inhibition or any restraint or any law, refusal to be under control. Now, oftentimes we find, I wouldn't say it's characteristic of anyone here, but oftentimes we find in young people, or even in older people too, but as they begin to be educated in the Christian life, and they find out about grace, and we're not under law, and you start to approach them about various things in their life, and maybe start to exhort them, challenge their thinking, and maybe even try and implement some guidelines for their life, some structure, and they say, man, don't put me under law. We live under grace. Don't put me under law, man. You're being legalistic here. And really, sometimes they're right, but sometimes what's really happening here is the inner working of lawlessness. The refusal to be under any kind of control. And that's not necessarily the same as living by grace, is it? No, it's the inward working of lawlessness. I refuse to be under any kind of restraint, any kind of control. And really what we have here is not a guy who is very mature for his age and is really walking by the Spirit. We have lawlessness working in his heart. God says that's characteristic of men. For until the law, sin was in the world, and sin at its very essence is lawlessness, the refusal to be under control. But sin is not imputed where there is no law. Individual sins are not reckoned to my account because there's no formal law. It has to be a formal law that I can transgress in order for individual sins to be counted to me. Like Adam, don't eat this fruit. Adam ate the fruit. He broke the law. He transgressed the law. That sin was reckoned to him. But from Adam to Moses, no formal law. But there's sin in the world, obviously, because all these bodies, all these graves, all these cemeteries, and that's the proof of the principle of federal headship. Sin, the spirit of rebellion, the spirit of self-will, the spirit of lawlessness is in the world. It's in men's hearts. And here you could even look at it as sin is personified. Sin entered the world. Sin was in the world. Okay? And from this section on, you can look at sin as actually kind of personified as this evil entity. And think of him as Satan. And think of him as just King Sin, this evil monarch in the world. Okay, so sin, the spirit of rebellion, of lawlessness, is in the world. Individual sins are not reckoned to my account because there is no formal law. Where there is no law, there is no transgression. Sin is not imputed where there is no law. Back to Romans chapter 4, verse 15. Romans chapter 4, verse 15. Because the law worketh wrath. For where no law is, there is no transgression. Where no law is, there is no transgression. What does that mean? Transgression means to step over the line. I can't step over the line if there's no line drawn. If somebody draws a line here and say, I dare you to step over that line, I step over the line, that's transgression. But until that line was there, no transgression. You come right up to the guy and get in his face, no transgression, there's no line drawn. I draw a line, step over the line, that's transgression. To step over the line, or a specific violation of a standard. Now, it's not saying here in Romans 5:12-14 that no man sinned during this time. It's saying there is no formal law. So their individual sins were not reckoned to their account. And yet, from Adam to Moses, all died. Sin as a principle was in the world, but no transgression. Individual sins were not counted against men, but everyone dies. Why does everyone die? That's the riddle. Federal headship. The answer to the riddle is federal headship. When Adam sinned, all sinned in Adam, according to God. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, so death passed upon all men, for they all have sinned. I don't think we're at all talking about individual acts of sin here. I believe what God is clearly saying is all men sinned in Adam. You may think that's unfair. Doesn't matter. It's the way it is. From God's perspective, when Adam acted in the Garden of Eden, Adam was the human race. More than just represented the human race, he was the human race because all the human race was, so to speak, in his loins, in potential, in seed form. All the human race was there in the Garden of Eden in the person of Adam, and when he acted. All sinned in Adam. Adam acted as a representative. Like Neil Armstrong was a representative stepping out, taking that first step from Apollo onto the moon, from that spacecraft onto the moon. He said, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. I understand, I've heard that he actually botched that. It's supposed to be one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. First words to say on the moon ever for a man, and he botches it, but that's the way it goes. But anyway, he represented mankind, right? When he did that. But it's even deeper than that. It's more than that. Adam was not just my representative. I was in Adam. Lou? Yes. They did deny God. They went their way into an ungodliness. But they did not inherit death because of that. Those individual sins were not counted to them, were not reckoned to their account in that sense, in an eternal positional sense. Okay? Yeah. Basically because of their inheritance from Adam, but then they followed it through and they carried the affliction even farther. Acts, though, the book of Acts tells us that there was a time when God winked at man's sin. Remember? And that's what it's talking about here. There was a time when God turned the other way, basically, from man's sin and allowed him to go his own way. But yes, he did bring judgment. He did bring wrath for that. But this is it more in a positional sense. He's looking at it more in a positional sense in terms of the consequences of death and life. From what we inherited. Was there another question? George and Dan? Right. Yes. That's right. That's what it's saying, exactly. Dan? Well, basically, his point is he's going to tell you that we inherited death and all that comes with it through Adam, but what we inherit through Christ, identification with that man, is going to be far superior, more than enough to undo all the damage done by Adam. That's his whole point, but he's just laying the foundation right now. Okay, as much as sin has ravaged your life, as much as sin has damaged and created disaster and catastrophe throughout the planet, what Christ did is more than sufficient to make you more than a conqueror over all that. The provision is absolutely more than sufficient to undo all the damage that Adam did and more. Okay, that's the whole point we're getting to, but we've got to lay the foundation here. So the basis of federal headship, the whole principle has got to be laid here, because it's the principle of federal headship that ensures your sanctification. I am crucified with Christ. But he's laying the groundwork here. Question? Yes. He's trying to prove a couple different points. He's saying he's trying to show that man is without excuse in Romans chapter 1, 2, and 3. He's trying to bring man under account, that every man is without excuse. No man is exempt. Every man has made his own bed or dug his own grave, so to speak, and must lie in it. He's without excuse, and here's what proves he's without excuse. Every man has light. Every man has individual light. But now we're looking at things from a totally different perspective. We're looking at how death came into the picture in the first place. We're looking at the principle of federal headship. And even if no man had sin, they're all held accountable because of Adam's sin. But he explained first that every man is individually accountable for the purpose of condemnation. Okay? For the purpose of condemnation. It does sound paradoxical, but you've got to look at it as two different perspectives God is taking on the human race. And is summing up the whole race in one person or another. And you cannot escape the consequences that accrue to you because of your identification with Adam. You cannot escape the consequences. No man is exempt, and God sums the whole thing up in one of two races. And that's the point he's making here. It's no contradiction. It may seem paradoxical. It's just two different perspectives. Okay? One is for the purpose of condemnation. The other is for the purpose of your identification with one race or another and what you inherit as a result. Okay? The answer to the riddle is federal headship. And the principle is described for us also in another passage in the Bible, Hebrews chapter 7. Hebrews chapter 7. Verse 4. Hebrews 7, verse 4. Now consider how great this man was, unto whom even the patriarch Abraham gave the tenth of the spoils. He's talking about Melchizedek, the king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. Verse 5, and verily they that are of the sons of Levi, who receive the office of the priesthood, have a commandment to take tithes of the people according to the law, that is, of their brethren, though they come out of the loins of Abraham. But he whose descent is not counted from them received tithes of Abraham and blessed him that had the promises. And without all contradiction, the less is blessed of the better. And here men that die receive tithes, but there he receiveth them, of whom it is witnessed that he liveth. And as I may say so, Levi also, who received tithes, paid tithes in Abraham. For he was yet in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. Okay, this is the principle of federal headship that we find in the case of Melchizedek and Abraham. The argument that is being set forth by the writer of Hebrews is Christ is a priesthood after the order of Melchizedek. Well, according to Levitical law, only those of the tribe of Levi, the Aaronic priesthood, were legitimate priests. God says Christ is a superior priest than to the Aaronic priesthood because he is a priest after the order of Melchizedek, which is a priesthood totally independent and unique and separate from the Aaronic priesthood. The Levitical law and the people of Moses, the children of Israel, recognize only one priesthood, that of Aaron. God says the priesthood of Christ is superior. It's the priesthood of Melchizedek. Aaron descended from Levi. Levi descended from Abraham. Levi was in Abraham when Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek. You pay tithes to one superior to you. It's also said Melchizedek blessed Abraham, and it says without contradiction, the less is blessed of the better. Therefore, Abraham is inferior to Melchizedek. Melchizedek is superior to Abraham. And Aaron was in Levi, and Levi was in Abraham when Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek. Therefore, the priesthood of Melchizedek is superior to that of Aaron. You follow? Good. Priesthood of Melchizedek is superior to that of Aaron because Aaron was in Levi. Levi was in Abraham when Abraham paid tithes to Abraham to Melchizedek, making Melchizedek superior to Abraham. Okay? Making Melchizedek superior to Aaron. And Christ superior to the Aaronic priesthood. That's the principle of federal headship. The bottom line is Adam's sin is imputed to me because of federal headship. Adam's sin is reckoned to me. Adam's sin is as good as mine in God's perception. It's as good as mine. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, that was Adam, and death by sin, well, that's his problem, not mine, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. Federal headship. I was in Adam in the Garden of Eden. I sinned in Eden. I sinned in Adam. It's not Adam's problem. It's my problem. Adam's sin reckoned to me. Adam's sin imputed to me, and all the consequences thereof. I sinned in Adam, therefore I receive Adam's consequences, and the consequence is death. And then we go on from there. Remember I told you to look at sin as personified. Sin is personified. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world. For until the law, sin was in the world. Okay? And so on throughout the rest of this passage. Now you're going to see someone else personified. Death. So here's these two ugly, evil guys roaming through the world. Sin and death. Personified. Nevertheless, death reigned, verse 14. Sin reigned, death reigned. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned, after the similitude of Adam's transgression, who is the figure of him that was to come. Death reigned, the Greek word is taken from the root word basileia, which means absolute king or monarch. Basileia is an absolute king or monarch. It's saying, it's telling us that death has ruled as absolute king over man's mortal existence. All of our existence, all of our life, our mortal experience here is tainted by death. That means physical death, separation of my spirit and soul from my body. These bodies don't last forever. The shortness of life and the fear of death haunts men from the time they're old enough to understand it. And from the time we're born, our cells are in the process of dying. And our bodies are subject to disease and deterioration. You may not recognize it now at your particular phase of life, but you will. Barring the rapture. Signs of deterioration. Takes a little bit longer to get in shape for the summer. Takes a little bit longer to get up and out of bed. Need a little bit more coffee to get through the day. Various signs of deterioration. Greater aches and pains. Age 40? No, I think it was age 41, 42. I was in a state of denial for a couple years, but around age 41, 42, it was getting hazier and hazier in the morning. Get up at 5 in the morning, have my Devos, put a little study, do a little study, and it's getting hazier and hazier. I'm thinking, you're just fatigued, you're in your eye strain. Because I was the last holdout in my family, and I thought I'd go to the grave without eyeglasses. The last holdout in my family. Everybody else, well, of course, they're all older than me, but they're all wearing glasses. They say, no, God has blessed me with great eyes. I'm going to take them with me to the grave. No, not so. Got blurrier and blurrier. Finally, I succumbed. Went to Walmart, optometrist. Hey, you need glasses. I need glasses. What's wrong with my eyes? Nothing. You just got old eyes. This happens at about age 40. I said, well, hasn't happened to Marv. He's my age, hasn't happened to Marv, why has it got to happen to me? Within a year or two, saw Marv wearing eyeglasses. It was a big change for me. It was kind of traumatic. All outward signs of what's happening inside, all the outward display of really the spiritual death that came into the world. Physical death is just the outward manifestation of spiritual death. And that's the next one. Physical death, spiritual death, separation of my spirit from God's spirit. You can look real good in the body. You can be physically alive. You can look like Tom Cruise, Cindy Crawford, Michelle Pfeiffer. Doesn't matter. Alienated from God, it's nothing but death masquerading as life. People walking around looking great, going to Victanis, look very much alive, vibrant, vigorous, full of verve, spiritually dead, dead as doornails. Look into their eyes, vacant, vacuum, void. Death masquerading as life. Spiritual death, there's eternal death, the final inevitable outcome, judgment, great white throne. Eternal separation from God, and the fear of that looms over our lives. All in all, it's death. Death has characterized man's existence. Death has ruled as absolute king over his mortal existence. It characterizes his life and experience. All that death brings with it. Listen, this is what death brings with it. It brings alienation. It brings a sense of futility. It brings fear, anxiety. It brings despair. Henry David Thoreau, early American writer, said, most men lead lives of quiet despair. He was a pagan. He was a naturalist. He was unsaved. He recognized that most men lead lives of quiet despair. I've known a few who lead lives of quite noisy despair. Leads to suicide, incorrigible selfishness, sin, violence, hatred. It's all death. Man's whole experience on earth is dominated by death. God created paradise. We've turned it into Coketown. Anybody ever read a Charles Dickens novel called Hard Times? Okay, one or two. In Hard Times, Charles Dickens talks about this place called Coketown. What it is the dawn of the industrial age, industrialization. They set up all these factories. You got all this smoke billowing out. You got people grinding away in labor 16 hours a day, and they're all just depressed, dingy people. They're in these factories polluting the air. He's already recognizing this years and years ago, Charles Dickens. And he called it Coketown. I used to work in Detroit. I used to repair two-way radios and install them for a small two-way radio company. And I used to go out on calls sometimes, and I would go down deep into the industrial section of the heart of Detroit. And there was this place called Zug Island. And on Zug Island, there were two clients that we had. One was King Scrap. It was a, you know, scrap place, junkyard. And another was Detroit Coke, where they did the smelting process to produce steel for the auto industry and everything. Detroit Coke, it was called. And I'll tell you what, you know, I hated going down to Zug Island because it was a dirty, dingy, depressing place. It was all run down. It was all filthy. The walls of the buildings were covered with this kind of soot, had this orange, grayish, purplish cloud hovering over all the time. Even the people walking around in the streets looked dingy. And they were depressed, and they were bent over, and they looked just awful. And I nicknamed it. I had read Charles Dickens' novel, Hard Times, and I nicknamed it Coketown, after the illustration Charles Dickens gave in that book. And that's what we've turned paradise into. God gave us Eden. He gave us lush, wonderful paradise. And because of sin, turned into Coketown. This depressing, death-like existence with despair and all that goes with death. When I ask you on a test, describe to me what it means that death reigned through man's mortal existence. Death dominated mortal existence. I don't want you to tell me it just means everybody dies physically. Don't tell me that. There's more to it than that. There's spiritual death, there's eternal death, and there's this cloud of death that just hangs over man's whole mortal existence. That all that brings with it, alienation and futility and despair. Death reigned. The fear of death. The whole alienation, the whole package that goes with it. When I ask you on a test what it means, death reigned, okay, don't just oversimplify it. You get it wrong. Okay, you're dismissed.